Here we are again.
Hello.
Well, hello.
I'm eating a delicious corn soup from the Vietnamese hole in the wall shop around the corner. My God.
I get the chicken and corn soup because
I've got tofu and corn because I'm morally superior to you.
Oh, have you got your moral high grounds cup yet?
I'm working on it. I was so, like, the other day when we made that joke about the moral high grounds, I'm like, that is the greatest thing to put on a smug reusable coffee cup. We should just do it.
You are just so proud of yourself.
And you just
you?
Know the fact that we're now saying this. If Gwen listens to this, she'll have turned out 100 of them.
By the time we stop recording, she'll be like,
where do you want me to post it?
If everyone, in case you don't know, our friend Gwen is the person who did those ban the single use Prime Minister bags that went unbelievably gangbusters. And Gwen was texting us and going, hey guys, guess what? I'm on Sunday Sunrise.
It was amazing. It was so funny.
It was absolutely amazing. Yeah. While we're on food, I share on the weekend, I cooked something that I ripped out of a newspaper. I can't remember where.
Was that the crab cakes?
Yes, and asparagus tart.
Yeah. I saw you posting on Facebook that you were murdering crabs.
I did. I used tinned crab. They were pre-murdered.
Okay. Yeah. So where do you tinned crab, like full, not even refrigerated tinned crab?
Yep, from Woolies in Marrickville.
Okay. No, that's fine.
You look judgy. I do. From your moral high ground.
I've just given you the margarine look, haven't I? Yes. We were flying to Perth the other day, and because I get a vegetarian order of my airline food, they always give you a little tub of margarine. Like, just because you're vegetarian doesn't mean that you just like yucky things.
And hilariously, she's held up the little tub of margarine in disgust. And then I've looked at mine and I've got that
pepe sayur butter. Delicious. Wasted on you.
It just seemed.
The red mist actually descended. Like, I was so cross and upset that you'd got this.
It was like somebody up the front was a Chat 10 listener and was taking a full lens.
It was so funny.
Yeah, that was hilarious.
Later, because we were staying in the same hotel when we did the Perth show, and it was that crazy day where we did that, well, frankly, disastrous Facebook Live where we didn't even know it was going, and then just rude things were said. I swore, and oh, God.
Well, that's right.
We did that. We had a nice breakfast in the morning. Then we did the terrible Facebook Live, and then you went and interviewed your secret snout.
Yes.
Smashing interview that you had.
Yeah, which is already aired now with Catherine Marriott. Yes.
Catherine Marriott was so sneaky.
Yeah.
And then I did a work thing that afternoon. And then what is the point of this? Where was it? Where did I start? God. All right. And you said, I'm going to order a tuna niçoise salad to my room. And I'm like, well, you hate tuna niçoise salad because when I served it to you, you were all polite, but then later confessed that you hated it and me because I'd served you tuna.
Yeah.
And
it's true.
Anyway.
It was out of a tin. That's where you were going because the
tinned
crab.
Tuna.
But I ate this one because it was like sashimi, tuna sashimi, or sort of seared, I think it was.
Anyway, you said that you'd like ordered this food to be delivered to your room at 4 p.m.
That was awesome that you could time it.
Yeah. And I tried to ring the hotel kitchen and ask them to put like a giant bowl of capers next to it. Like, it's going to say on it. And this guy's just like, I'm sorry. Miss Sales will have to order her own capers. It was like a sort of, needles in strawberries situation. Oh, there was like,
I love how that they're probably in the kitchen at that hotel going, God, that Lee Sales is such a monster that she gets her assistant to ring to ask for the capers.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Totally.
Was
where
fun
were we?
Could I just ask, you were watching on the flight. I was hooked into a thing I was watching called Feud, so I didn't watch any of the in-flight stuff. But you watched an Alexander McQueen doco.
Oh, my God. I sure did.
Was it good?
It was great. Mm-hmm. So, look, I knew a bit about Alexander McQueen, sort of, bad boy of British fashion sort of thing, and that he had, had this completely sort of revolutionary impact on the British fashion scene. He's this sort of like Cockney bogan who turned up and, started making clothes that were kind of violent and sensational and like from really cheap materials. And then he was hired by Givenchy to be their designer. And anyway, I sort of read a little bit more about him when we went to see that Isabella Blow exhibition at the Powerhouse a year or two back.
She was like his muse.
Right, yeah. Right. And so she wore his clothes and kind of pushed him, and she was this sort of zeitgeisty sort of hat-wearing, interesting woman who was like a vector in the fashion world. Anyway, they're both dead now because, well, I think they both took their own lives, right? Like, I mean, she was very ill. So they both died young. But this documentary looks at using sort of old home videos of him as a kid and as a young man. He went to fashion school, had no, like, really had no book learning at all. And so, but started kind of reading all this literature and having all of these quite revolutionary ideas about fashion design. But also, and this is so funny, like, I just, he also always didn't look like a fashion designer. Like, he's overweight and sort of terrible teeth and, would be wearing, like, he looked like he was dressed from Kmart, you know, and yet he'd be sort of, he's all of a sudden, he's the sort of head of Givenchy. But then what was interesting, I thought, was over the course of his time at Givenchy, and he was also spending 6 months a year in London designing McQueen, his own line, and he kind of got less and less happy and more miserable and more successful. And he had surgery and liposuction to kind of change his appearance. And he started doing quite a lot of drugs, I think, which really didn't help him. And so he sort of ended up eliminating all of the stuff that had made him quite remarkable. It was just, God, so sad. Just, and because he, like, his shows were absolutely extraordinary and so much more about theatre and drama than about fashion, although he obviously was an incredibly shrewd businessman. He had, like, ready-to-wear and marketable retail clothing that was very high-end. He was a great tailor. But his main artistic sort of expression were these shows that were just these extraordinary works of theatre. And it was incredible in the film to see all of those and just see this operatic madness that captivated him, and looking at the themes that he looked at and developed in these shows. It was just like a real lesson in how short the bridge between theatre and fashion can be.
That sounds right up my alley.
It's a great film. I really enjoyed it.
I wonder how hard it is if you work in a field which is a lot about appearance, so fashion or modelling or whatever, and you're a designer or a photographer or a makeup artist, so you're not somebody who is paid to look amazing, but you are always around people who look amazing and in something that's very heavily focused on appearance. I wonder how much that starts to eat your psyche.
Well, evidently it must. I thought that one of the most interesting and impressive things about him was how absolutely self-possessed he was in the light of, you know, mockery and people going, what, you know, what's this guy doing? You know, he seemed incredibly grounded in his own family background and his own confidence in what he wanted to do. And in the early parts of the documentary, you're just amazed that this kid who kind of came from nowhere, had this extraordinary ambition and also confidence in his own abilities. There's this great moment in the film where he has just pulled off this extraordinary show in London Fashion Week, and he's the hot new name. You know, all of the fashion writers are writing about him, and he leaves the show, and he and his colleague can't, they don't have enough money to buy burgers at McDonald's, you know, and they just have no money. And they've built, like, they've made these clothes out of bin liners and, you know, all sorts of found materials and whatever. You just think that they could step from this world of incredible opulence into, he said, look, I was on unemployment benefit at the time, and that's how I, you know, I spent my doll money. I lived with my parents. I spent my doll money on fabric, you know, in these sort of, I knew where to get cheap fabric. And yeah, amazing.
Wow.
Absolutely amazing.
That is just absolutely incredible.
And he's built this extraordinary empire, you know. Anyway, it's, yeah. I have you to thank for my emerging weakness for fashion documentaries, but this is a real, like, it's great.
Yeah, I do. I love the fashion documentaries as a genre. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why. Look at me.
I love you. Look, you're very attractive in your own way. Sorry.
Don't make me laugh. I've still got cold sores.
Oh, no.
You're
the full glamour package, really, aren't
you? Totally. When you said about him and the way that he dressed like Kmart, I was thinking the same about Grace Coddington at Vogue, who she's always just wearing black. She's got that hair that just looks fright, and she just looks positively dowdy. And yet her eye to make everything else look absolutely phenomenal is just
that's amazing, isn't it?
Off the charts.
Oh, no. Yeah. Isabella Blow always looked pretty great, though.
Yeah, but it's
like a walking billboard for other people, like other designers.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
She's not, I guess maybe if you are the brain that's coming up with all this stuff, you don't put it on yourself.
And
you don't get high on your own supply. So to speak.
I saw a line in a piece about Donald Trump the other day where they described him sitting around getting high on the smell of his own sulfur.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, like farting in a lift or something. God, I'm still going through that book. It's just, oh my gosh, it's just.
Oh, man alive.
Every turn.
What else have you been doing?
Speaking about, I'm not finished with other art forms yet.
Oh.
In fact, I might spend this whole podcast just talking about things that aren't books.
Okay. That'll be great for our new bedside table initiative, which is our
exactly.
little online bookstore.
I'm just going to go straight into dance now.
We'll tell you more about that later. Yeah. Yep.
So, you know, I was stunned a couple of weeks ago when you revealed your newfound love for poetry.
The poetry of Kate Kennedy.
Right, you start with one and then it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
And I am here to report that I have seen and enjoyed a musical.
WTF.
Well, see, now when you kept going on to me about Calamity Jane and how brilliant Virginia Gay was, mm-hmm. I just gave it the whole Americans treatment, really. How interesting
God,
can this woman be? How fabulous can a musical be?
And then I roped her into doing our
show. Then you roped her into doing our show at the end more. I'm like, holy shit, Sales, this woman's a genius. And you're like, I know. But she's, I don't know why she isn't in everything that I see. Like, she is the most galvanizing talent. She is an all-consuming presence. She's just, anyway, so I like, you know, anyone else has sort of seen the film of Calamity Jane.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think, well, who else is going to play that role? Like,
oh,
you know.
Yeah. It's like one of Doris Day's most famous roles.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and so that sort of brassy lady kind of thing. Okay. So Virginia Gay's adaptation of the role for the live show that I saw at Belvoir, and I think it's now heading back to Melbourne again for another season before the end of the year, is just, it could not be more different. You know, she's kind of growly and gutsy, and the voice is just like, yeah, it has a presence of its own. Like, she's absolutely gobsmacking.
It's incredible, isn't it, to see somebody do a role that is so associated with someone else and they just bring something so new and fresh to it and amazing. You're just like, wow, that's how it should have always been done. Like, you know, it just seemed
so
right.
Plus so much humour, like there's such localised humour to it. Like, there seemed to be, like, there was a lot of just, you know, the actors are having such a great time. They were throwing lines in. Like, it just seemed, and it was at Belvoir, right, so one of my favourite moments was when so some of the other actors were just like thrown or spat like whiskey all over Calamity, and she like loses it, and she's like, ah, God. And one of the others says, well, Pamela Rabe wouldn't have complained. There was like a Rabe joke there because, you know.
Was that because they knew you were there?
No, I think it's because Pamela Rabe is like such a huge name at Belvoir. Like, she's such a. But there were just all of these jokes, you know, that were chucked in that were just so beautiful.
And there was a tuba player in it.
There's a tuba player in it. I know, yeah. Anyway, so thank you belatedly for that recommendation.
No, it was fantastic.
Wasn't it? I ran into the artist Del Catherine Barton, who was there as well. And, gee, she's an interesting one. I really enjoyed meeting her. She was just randomly there as well. And I said, did you enjoy the show? And she said, well, look, to be honest, I hate musicals. I hate comedies of any kind. And I hate period pieces of any kind. I'm like, ooh, are you sure you should be?
She's like, cool.
And she said, but I'm loving it. And
oh,
I said,
great.
I really connected with her over that because she was,
No, there was something about it. It was really fantastic. This probably will mean nothing to you because you don't care about musical theatre, but I'm just going to throw it out there because I know some of our listeners do. What I would absolutely love to see Virginia Gay have a stab at would be another role very much associated with someone else, which is Funny Girl. I'd like to see her do the Barbara Streisand role in Funny Girl.
Oh, now you're talking.
Because, I mean, I watched that film again not so long ago, so it's Barbara Streisand, Omar Sharif.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara is just – it's just no surprise that that's why she became such a massive star. Like, yeah. She just is just eating up the screen. Like, yeah. It is gobsmacking. And just her talent is just – oh, God. Anyway, I just think that Virginia Gay has got a similar sort of – charisma and quality, and I think her voice would suit some of the Funny Girl songs, and I'd love to see her have a red hot go at it. But then I also think, well, I don't know, do you bother reinterpreting something that's so done? But then, you know, that's what they did with Calamity Jane, so, you know,
she got the charisma.
Exactly. So anyway, I'd like to see her have a red hot go at that too.
I've got another thing to mention, unless I just politely wait to see if you'd like to avail yourself of this spare
of oxygen. I've only got like little tiny bits that I can bang out in a minute at the end. So why don't you carry on?
Okay. Very well.
Since I did get the last episode to bang on and on and on and on about my
your own
book.
Work. Yes. Which everybody should buy if you haven't yet. Any Ordinary Day, Lee Sales, full of revelations. I went to see the first half of Harp in the South, the production by the Sydney Theatre Company. Yep. Oh, my lordy. It's such a good piece of theatre. Mm. So it's like 5.5 hours of theatre. I went to see the first half.
Haven't been to the second half yet.
No, I haven't quite got round to it. But so did you love those books, like The Harp in the South, Poor Man's Orange,
Read them. I wasn't one of those people that absolutely adored them. My childhood friend Mandy absolutely loved them.
Mandy, this is why I play the role of Mandy.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Did you love them?
Mm.
All right.
Yeah, I did. And it's an incredible cast, right? Like it's a brilliant cast, and the direction's extraordinary. They account really intelligently for the passage of time and for the fact that, you know, one character, you know, each character ages.
Right. You've
got this very beautiful way of effecting the transition where Margaret, who's the matriarch of the family, and her husband Huey, they move to Surry Hills with their newborn baby, Thady.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking, how are they going to, like, because then for the rest of the book, like, Margaret, who's known as Mama in the story, you know, she's a woman with two like teenage and children, and how are we going to change the character from this young girl who's just had a baby? And so the way they do it, and the staging is the actual real work of genius of this production. It's a completely bare stage with a big round like turntable thing that spins every now and again to connote the passage of time.
Wow.
And what happens is that they march off with their baby and hand in hand, and they walk across the stage, and approaching them from the other side comes this older couple with a little boy who's like about 10 holding his hand, and they meet in the middle and they shake hands, and then the younger couple leaves. So it's like a direct handover of the role. It's so
that's
beautiful.
Fantastic. That's so clever.
And you're in absolutely no doubt as to what's just happened. You have watched the changing of these characters on a stage with nothing else happening. Like, it's just so bold, but just
is that what'll happen in The Crown?
I don't know. Completely. I spend about 10% of my brain is just worrying about that transition at any given time. But so
that's
it was beautiful.
Fantastic.
But like, the other thing about the staging was obviously a lot of the action happens inside the house lived in by Mama and Huey and the sisters Roey and Dola, and all of their bizarre lodgers that they have in this little squeezy Surry Hills terrace. And so they've built this terrace house by basically they've got these tall sort of scaffolding structures on wheels, and they just, the set hands just like race these structures in and pop them together, and they've got stairs and like bedrooms, but no walls, so you can see straight through them. So you can see what's happening in any part of the house at any time.
God.
And they just and they can break the set in seconds by just pulling these contraptions off stage.
What theatre is this done in?
Sydney Theatre Company. So it's at the Rospacker Theatre. Oh, so it's that big, big theatre. We've filled it. You know that one. Sorry. I'm just doing it like.
What a monster.
Yeah.
An absolute monster.
But it was, yeah. So it's exhilaratingly well produced.
Can I just also give a shout out to the Sydney Theatre Company for their season next year, which the brochure landed on my desk at work the other day and I flicked through it. It is just. Like every single thing I went, oh, God, that looks fantastic. And then the one that I particularly just nearly wet my pants
is – I know what you're about to say.
Mm-hmm. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Pamela Rabe and Hugo Weaving.
I have no more remarks to make about that beyond – I just remember you texted me just like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God.
I mean –
I share Hugo, your OMG.
Hugo Weaving I find just astonishing in every single thing that I ever see him in.
Did you see him in Macbeth?
No.
Oh,
How did I miss that?
Yeah, no, it was,
I remember seeing Uncle Vanya, and it was that production where it was like every superstar of Australian acting.
It was like the Cate Blanchett,
Cate Blanchett, John Bell, Richard Roxburgh, Hugo Weaving. It was just every single person, household name. And the one person on that stage with that group of people that I could not take my eyes off was Hugo Weaving. And it wasn't because he was being an upstager or that he was pulling focus or anything. It's just because his sheer presence is just so strong. I just think he's extraordinary. And then I think we all know how we feel about Rabe.
Rabe!
Can I, before we run out of time, just do a quick whip around a few things?
Some noodling.
Noodling. Am I overusing the word noodling?
I just love that verb.
The Split, which I said a few podcasts ago that I was watching. It's a BBC drama. It's on the ABC. I've been watching it on iView. I was a bit cold on it. I'm now up to about episode 4, episode 5, and it's just only now really put its hooks into me.
Ah, okay.
It's no Americans, but it's pretty solid.
You can see America from there, can you?
I don't even know if I could say that I could see America from there. Hey, speaking of which, the Americans won some awards in the Emmys the other week, including Matthew Reese won for his performance as Philip. Somebody tweeted, which made me laugh, they said – Kerry Russell being overlooked, but Matthew Reese getting an award is like Elizabeth having to keep on doing the killings and the spying while Philip horsed around doing line dancing and effing up the travel agency. So true.
Harsh but fair.
The new season of Mad as Hell has started on the ABC, which I'm a gigantic fan of. And I just sort of like, you know, the other week we were talking about 30 Rock and how just pound for pound, there's just line after line after line after line. It's funny. Mad as Hell is the same, I reckon, where you're missing funny lines because you're still laughing from the previous funny line. There was a thing this week I had to pause and I reckon I laughed for about 5 minutes and it was just so silly that I just laughed and laughed. It was a fake promo for an ABC nature documentary. And so it opens and it's shots of ants and the voice the voiceover goes, "These ants can carry 3 times their own body weight, but they don't. Join us for Bludger Ants of the Nullarbor." And a lot of his, it was funny because as I was watching it, I was thinking, like, I think Sean McAuliffe does, you know, some of the best political commentary around through satire. I think it's just really sharply observed. And there were several moments in it where he said things and I just thought, God, that just reminds me of Crabbe. Like the sort of, the way that he was analysing stuff, it reminded me of you. There was another great line about Roman Quadvlig, which was Roman Quadvlig, a name once respected, if not pronounced with any certainty. Anyway, it's just the usual reliably excellent quality. I'm reading Clock Dance by Anne Tyler, which is Anne Tyler's latest novel. Mm-hmm. I would say if you are someone who likes Anne Tyler's shtick, you will love it. Anne Tyler, I think, writes really awesome, very finely observed books about family and family dynamics and family relationships. Some people feel like it's sort of – people can be dismissive of it. They say it's like chick lit and stuff, but I actually think it's really very well done. Our friend Murph sent us a thing that appeared in McSweeney about Middle of the Night Worries.
I love McSweeney's. It's just – Every now and again, there's something that just is so ludicrously apt and hilarious.
That was just absolutely gold. So it's basically somebody.
What's it called? The theatre of your mind. It's yeah. 2:47 a.m.
And it goes through all of the things that you tend to be preoccupied by at that hour, like somebody who you accidentally
got their name wrong 15 years ago in exactly. the stock room.
Yep. And then, of course, when you reach the point where you're calculating how many hours you still have left to sleep and how you're eroding it as you stay awake. And anyway, it's brilliantly
Plus, climate
done.
Change is real.
It's brilliantly done. It's really, really hilarious. And that's about That's me up to date.
I will close with another art form because I can do so many in the space of a simple half hour.
Interpretive dance.
I went to Melbourne at the weekend to shoot a pilot for the new ABC TV show I'm doing with Charlie Pickering. Mm-hmm. It's called Tomorrow Tonight. Mm-hmm. It is an ambitious, but I can report after the pilot, thank God, successful. Yeah, I know. So, we had great fun doing that, but I didn't start work on Saturday until like 12. So I went to the NGV to see the MoMA exhibition, which is in its final weeks, and lots and lots of good stuff in there. But the thing that I loved walking in and seeing first up was this beautiful Vincent van Gogh artwork, which is a painting of his friend, the postie. And it's one of those ones where the background is incredibly decorative and intricate and his friend is sort of smiling-ish and he's got a kind of completely comical beard and the colours are beautiful. It's just I love that painting. It's there's a series because I just think, you know, we all read about how miserable Vincent van Gogh's life was and how, you know, he chopped off his own ear and went mad and did all of that stuff. And I always find it that series a really cheering one because it's such a great evidence that even when you are desperately down on your luck and professionally unsuccessful and frustrated and ill and whatever else, you can still have these great moments of just pure joy and exultation in your friend's company. And it's a beautiful painting and it makes me
And that's
happy.
What you see when you walk straight in.
Yeah, you walk straight in and there it is.
So let me ask you about one that I saw you either tweet or Instagram a photo of and I didn't get it. I wasn't sure why you were drawn to it. It's like Alphabet.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's all sorts of different stuff in this exhibition. Like it tries to sort of it kind of charts almost a history of the MoMA collection. So there's different artistic periods and like there's like incredible big blockbustery, you know, sort of works that you're really familiar with. So they're very fun to see, obviously. But then there's other forms and this was from a little section on the Bauhaus sort of movement and it was just a set of you know, fonts, you know, letterprint kind of, I just found it very pleasing, that's all.
Oh, okay. I was looking at it trying to decipher, like, what is it in this?
No, there cheese? Wasn't some crazy message in there or anything. I just found it visually pleasing, that's all. Conversation over, really, that was it. But there was also a kind of participatory artwork in there as part of the exhibition as well. And it
Not this counting rice palaver again.
No, but it's – you can with see respect. America from here.
with all due respect to Marina Abramovich.
It's a work called Roman Ondak, Measuring the Universe, it's called. And it's a room of blank walls and you walk in and there are a couple of attendants from the art gallery in there. And when you go in, they say, would you like to be a part of the artwork? And you say, yes, please. And they've got a texter in their hand, like a black texter. And they get you to stand against the wall and they measure you. Like it's all about the tradition of measuring your children against the wall and marking. And so they measure your height and then they write next to it your name and the date you came into the exhibition, right? And so obviously it's near the end of the exhibition now. So what there is now is this great sort of fuzzy cloud, insect cloud at the average height level. It's all filled in. So it looks like this giant sort of smudge running around the wall at exactly the same level, but with sort of fuzzy bits of like there's
up and down.
Yeah. And it's so funny because, and people have put their children. So there are still legible names among the unusually statured people that have come in. So they're very tall people. You can still read their names.
Right.
And it's so funny because they're all Dutch, basically. Hello, here is Hans.
And all the little
ones. And then
ones.
The little ones are all called, like, you know.
Jordan.
No, they're all called, like, you know.
Isabella.
Yeah, totally. Like, as you look at the different heights, you can see the trends of names. Like, it's really interesting. And of course, I'm sort of a bit average, so my name was just written in black on an already black. You know, so mine is invisible.
Yeah.
Anyway, I loved it.
That sounds great. That sounds super cool.
Yeah.
Okay, we're out of time because I've got to go to a meeting.
Okay.
So let me just yell out for a few things. If you like what we talk about in the book sense, which actually this episode's only been three books,
just totally useless.
Harp in the South, Clock Dance, and my own book, Any Ordinary Day.
I am going back to reread Harp in the South, Poor Man's Orange, and Mrs. though. So it's sort of a book recommendation.
Well, then that's perfect because now all of those books can be put on our new online book page, which is Chat 10 Looks 3 Bedside Table, and you can get to that by going to chat10looks3.com. And so everything that we talk about book-wise in the podcast, if you're interested, you can now just click on this page. It's hooked up to Booktopia.
It's like
it'll
our
take
own
you through.
Little bookshop. So you can wander around. I wanted to call it Sales's Bin, but somebody said no.
I'm
sitting
also,
in a room with her right now.
Brenda 2.0 Beck has set up an Instagram account for Chat 10. So if you're on Instagram, you can follow that at Chat 10 Looks 3.
I've posted a series of amusing root vegetables.
I have
more to come.
Seen the fascinating posts that you've been putting on there. And yes. And there's some tickets on sale to our Melbourne show if you would like to come along, which should be very fun in November.
On the 16th of November.
Yep.
We're having a pop-up bar as well.
Ooh,
so you get
exciting.
To come and hang out with the Chatterati.
Very good. And you can still go into the Facebook group if you want, which you've got to answer some questions to join, like, you know, who do you prefer out of Annabelle Crabb and Lee Sales?
What are you wearing right now? That sort of thing. Pretty straightforward.
And that's it.
Okay.
So, yeah, we'll see you soon.
Well, this has been highly successful.
Very successful. See ya.
Bye. Oh, are we live?
Hit it.
So, here's the thing. You know how Gwen is completely out of control? Remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about my sad reusable coffee cup and how I always feel a bit smug even though my cup is sad when I'm in the coffee line and, you know, I've remembered to bring a reusable cup. And then we started talking about how it really felt you made you feel you had the moral high grounds and we really should have a cup that just says moral high grounds. Well, guess what?
Now we do.
Gwen's
late
Gwen,
got straight onto it.
She's gone mad. The police will shoot her. But before they do, you can actually order this cup.
And because she knows that we're a shambles at promoting stuff, she's actually sent us the exact words that us to say. Yes. She said,
we
are selling them online now. Each coffee cup sold will allow OzHarvest to provide 5 meals to Australians who need them. Moral High Grounds cups are available at chat10looks3.com. Or
something similar.
Oh, that's right. That's she doesn't want us to read on. Okay, so they're available on the Chat 10 website.
So you go to the Chat 10 website and there's a little shop there and you can get coffee cups and you can have them sent or there are even, organised by Gwen, a couple of cafes where you can collect them in Melbourne or Sydney. I'm sorry, only in Melbourne and Sydney at this stage, but that's where the greatest cluster of
And
of
just to avoid
is.
Postage. So,
So that's very good. And, of course, because proceeds go to OzHarvest, you can be even smugger. In fact, it's a smug overload. You'll have to go and get your smug gland removed afterwards. Right, I think it's been long enough, hasn't it?
Plenty long enough.